Now, with your GoDaddy.com domain registration, as a listener of The Chris Perillo Show, enter code CHRIS1 and save an additional 10% on any order. Get your piece of the internet at GoDaddy.com.
Bennett, I think I broke it. Have you heard that joke before?
No. I was going to say I'm too young, but you're not much older than me, so you're going to have to explain it.
You know, you know who you sound like? You sound like...
I get Tom Hanks once in a while. Tom Hanks? I don't get that. I look like...
Dr. Phlox from Enterprise.
That's a new one. I've gotten Glenn Humplink from the Tom Green Show. That's a look like. Robert Wool, who's a comedian, been in some movies. Not Dr. Phlox. Do I sound like him or look like him?
No, you sound like... Why would you look like him? I mean, who looks like Dr. Phlox walking around?
I wouldn't know. I don't know what he looks
like. Well, you got to be a Star Trek fan. Yeah, he's an alien. You got to... Resistance is futile if... What is that? Less than 1 ohm?
Right. So, see, it's not really a Star Trek reference. It's more of a physics reference.
Right. Because physicists just walk around saying resistance is futile.
If it's less than 1 ohm, they do.
So what would he mean?
An ohm?
Yeah. I mean, I understand an ohm. Isn't it a unit of power?
It's a unit of resistance in a wire.
Okay.
That's the joke.
Oh.
You can get
this
on thinkgeek.com. Resistance is futile if less than 1 ohm.
But Star Trek geeks think it's for them, when in fact it's not. It's for physicists.
Right. Or Girl Scouts think it's for them. I saw an ad campaign for a while with Girl Scouts on the side of buses holding the Girl Scout cookie saying resistance is futile. I thought that was cute.
So you're equating the Girl Scouts to the Borg?
They did. Or perhaps it was only in my mind, but I think that was the connection they're meaning for people to draw.
Fair enough. Okay, peacefire.org. What is your mission in life other than to screw everything up for the rest of us?
But then I can charge you for putting it back together into working order again.
Fair
That's
enough.
The point. We got started because about 10 years ago, the first big internet censorship laws were being proposed, and I thought there was a lot of talk about how they would affect the rights of adults, but not a lot of talk about how they would affect the rights of minors. And I think what a lot of the controversy came down to was that I fundamentally believe that, you know, for most of our history, teenagers have been considered more like adults than like children. I mean, right up until the last couple of centuries, I mean, once you got to be 12, 13, you're basically considered, you know, a working, contributing member of society. And I think what happened recently is that as jobs in the world got more complicated, it became necessary to stay in school longer before you could start going out and working. But the mistake that people made is that just because you have to stay in school longer, that doesn't mean that the natural age of human maturity has gone up. It doesn't automatically raise the age at which you're able to be responsible and intelligent. And so we've got this sort of zone of years in adolescence where technically you're probably prepared to be an adult, but we still have these crazy rules like if you're 17, you're not mentally competent to get a library card, not without your parents' permission.
Did you just call it a library card?
I said library. I haven't been listening to the
All right. Well, I'm just making sure you said library card. Okay.
Library, yes. Yeah. Liberians are the ones that send you those emails saying that you need to transfer, you know, $5,000 advance fee before they can send you money from their national bank.
Well, that's actually happened to me. I get those emails. I try to stay in touch with those guys because I want to make sure they're doing okay.
Did they come through? The UPS box is full of cash?
Not yet, but I'm waiting. I mean, they promised and everything, and I've, you know, kept following up with them, but I don't know. It seems like after I send them the money, they must be fine because I never hear from them again.
Oh, good. So well, I actually thought about trying to take some of them for a ride once, combining two internet scams. There's another one where, you know, certain Caribbean countries have phone numbers that you can set up where if you call that number, it looks like an American zip code, but once you get on the line, it costs like $1 a minute to stay on. So I thought about trying to get one of those numbers and then giving it to the people that email you from Nigeria or wherever and telling them that is my contact phone number. It turns out that that's actually getting harder to set those up now, and also the scammers have caught on to people doing that, and they now tell you to call them or email them rather than then making the first phone call.
Oh, naturally.
So
it makes sense. I mean, scammers got to stay ahead of this.
Mm-hmm.
But this is your background. I mean, you understand kind of how to get around the system, so to speak. Isn't this what peacefire.org is all about?
Yeah, getting around some systems, one in particular. We have software and methods listed on our site for specifically getting around blocking software. And I think, like I said, I think this grew out of what I strongly believed was that teenagers are more like adults than children, and it just sort of disgusted and depressed me for a long time that people were talking about how necessary it was to put controls on all people under 18 when using the internet. So a lot of these techniques that we have on our site have become popular for people who wanted to get around blocking software at home or at school, as well as people A lot of people use it to get around blocking software at work. We've heard from quite a few people in the military, because apparently the United States Armed Forces uses WebSense to filter internet access for its soldiers overseas, because I guess if you enlist to fight in a war, God forbid you should be exposed to seeing anything bad, so they have to be careful.
But they're using techniques on your website to kind of get around that stuff now.
All right, they've contacted us.
Wait a minute. Isn't that really upsetting all the sensorware companies? All the people who create products that you're, I guess, breaking through?
Yeah, well, you'd think so, but the couple times that they've really come after us hard, like tried to take us to court and stuff, it wasn't so much because we published methods for getting around their software. What we did was publish methods for people to get access to the list of sites that they block. See, most of these programs, you install them on their computer, and there's a database on the that comes to the program that has the blocked sites, but it's encrypted. You're not supposed to be able to read it.
Right.
And we would do things like give people software that people could use to decrypt the list of blocked sites that came with the program so you could study it and see, you know, what proportion of errors it contained, which is some of the studies that we did too, was looking through random samples of the sites and seeing how many of them were blocked erroneously. And that is something that has brought their wrath down on us far more than distributing methods for getting around the software ever has.
Because
I don't think they really care so much about if people get around the software, because, you know, if you're a parent and you install this stuff, you're just going to test it a little to make sure it blocks Playboy, and then you're done with it. And if the kid finds a way around it, they're not going to tell their parents. And even if their parents did know, it's not like they could get their money back for the program, probably. So there's not a lot of, from a money-making point of view, there's not a lot of pressure on them to make the software secure against people getting around it. There are other customers or schools and libraries and businesses that often buy it just for liability protection. They don't really care if it works or not. They just have to have something. So there's no business reason for the blocking software companies to really care if people can get around it or not.
Now, I don't know. Jake, you just got a call. Is this a call that we need to take? Come on. Oh, but those are fun. The press one now.
You can see them. Well, we should have read their number, and I can tell you how to do it. You can see those people.
Really? How?
In Washington state laws, I mean, it was a pre-recorded message, right? If they dial numbers and play a pre-recorded message, you can take them from the court. It's also federal law. It says nonprofits are for-profit companies are never allowed to do it. If it's a nonprofit, under limited circumstances, they can do it if they have a callback number in the message. But I've done that a couple of times because I've been to small claims court against suing spammers under Washington's anti-spam law. And so once I got the hang of that, I'd done some telemarketers too. But yeah, you can see them.
So you actually make money then from this, or?
I have a couple times.
Like mad cash, like you can retire?
Not big time money. I mean, if you wanted to make big money, I'd say save up lots of mails from one particular company, you know, that you think would have enough money to make it worth going outside of small claims and going to a real court and sue them with the help of a lawyer. If you want to sue someone in small claims, first of all, you're limited to $4,000, and most of the time it's just going to be some spammer who spammed you one time, so it'll be more like just $1,000.
You know what I got today? Now, I don't think it was spam necessarily, but I'm inclined not to believe it, and it was an excellent marketing tactic if this was the case. It came to bugs@gotta.be, so bugs mm-hmm. @gada.be, and it was a legit email. It was from a senior account representative at Dell, saying Michael Dell had suggested that you are potentially going to be a big account. We were wondering if, you know, who would be the CTO or the person to be in touch with. It's like, why the hell would they send it to that email address?
Bugs?
Because it's public, but that was the only, it was bugs@gotta.be, and it's like, I can't imagine that a senior account representative would do that. So I thought it was a ploy. So instead of responding by email, I call the guy. He was like totally off guard. And it sounded all like it was a sales call. Sounds like a perfect way of doing it, though, doesn't it? Like, if your company was identified by Michael Dell as a leading company and a new up-and-coming company, then wouldn't you want to be contacted?
Yeah, I guess if it were me, I'd just call him and say, like, do you remember sending mail to me? And, you know, maybe if he'd send it to, say, 10 or fewer people, I wouldn't consider that spam. But, like,
yeah,
if he remembers you individually... Well, that's the thing. It'd be like, I was the guy that you just emailed about Michael Dell thinking we'd be a big account. How many different people could I possibly be? How many guesses would it
exactly.
take you to
yeah.
know who
and
I
that's
am?
Kinda, and that's kind of how I set it up. Like, do you remember, you know? And he did. It sounded like, oh, yes, okay, I jogged his memory. But it just seemed really odd that the email, like I said, it's a genius marketing tactic if this was the case. But it wasn't form letterish necessarily. I mean, it was like a legitimate. It looked like a legitimate email, not like someone had composed in an email program and mass distributed it. So it looked legit. So to me, I was more inclined to believe that this was a legitimate email, but it was crafted in such a way, like, why wouldn't Michael Dell then contact me directly? Why would he be sending me through a senior account representative?
Mm-hmm.
Does that make any sense?
Did they even say, Dear Chris? No, they didn't have any information.
Well, I've still got the email in the other room. We'll have to take a look at it.
Yeah, because who would know Gotta Be and think this is what without I'm being able to say, Dear Chris?
Well, not just that, but... Who knows about Gotta Be? I mean, you know, come on. Even I'm not that stupid. I mean, it's flying so far under the radar right now.
I don't know. So, I thought I'd heard about it a couple different places, but yeah, it takes a while.
Yeah, but Michael Dell, come on. Yeah, exactly. I mean, if it was a little, maybe just a little bigger, I'd believe it. But Michael Dell himself, I doubt it. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Maybe he just wanted to get you before you became really, really big. So but huge the, that he couldn't
right,
get through your PR
sure.
defenses.
Well, you know, it's so tough to kind of look at these scams these days and think about, you know, things that you can do for retribution or if they're real, if they're fake, mm-hmm. you know, you just can't tell anymore. It's impossible. Some of this stuff is crafted so well.
Yeah, I got a call from someone. See if you can think how you would handle this, but I got a call from someone saying it was Kevin Mitnick, you know, the famous hacker,
yeah, sure.
saying
no,
he
I
wanted to... have you talked to him? You met him?
Oh, yeah.
That
no, I... Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, he called and said, okay, this is Kevin Mitnick, and I'm wondering if you'd want to be interviewed on my radio show. So think. All right, what's your date of birth? And he told me whatever it was. And then I had to go to Google and check what it really was. But I figure someone pretending wouldn't have that information in their head if they're just trying to pretend to be Kevin.
Sure.
But, yeah, it was really...
It was legitimate.
It was for real.
Did you meet Darcy?
No, I don't know
I don't
who
know
that
if
is.
She's
Sorry.
Doing any... I don't know if they're still boyfriend, girlfriend or not, but... No, that's when that I met Kevin when I was at Tech TV.
Okay.
So, you know, I haven't met Kevin in person. He's a nice guy. I mean, you'd never look at him and think, wow, he's a computer genius. He just wouldn't. He doesn't look that way.
Mm-hmm.
He looks like, you know, one of the guys that's just too cool for the room, not like a geek.
Yeah. That probably enabled him to get away with a lot of the stuff that he did. The people just didn't think he was the...
How so?
Look at him and think computer geek.
Wait a minute,
well,
how so?
His specialty, I thought, was... My understanding was that his specialty was social engineering, which
yes.
was not the technical side of hacking, but just being able to persuade people, oh, hey, I'm from the company. I need this code number to get in. And I think that maybe for that, the sort of the too cool for the room nature is more of an advantage when people wouldn't look even think, you know, scheming
the charisma,
computer
right.
wizard.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So PeaceFire's got a whole bunch of information about how to screw with everything. Not everything in general. But
some
I mean,
specific things.
Specific things.
Blocking
software and websites. I mean, what do you think? Is censorship then just alive and well on the internet?
I think that it depends on who you are. I mean, we have a lot of users in some countries where internet access is censored, and like in China and Middle Eastern countries. And I think that one of the fallacies that people have believed over the years was that internet censorship would be impossible in countries like those, and the information would just trickle in, and the government couldn't do anything to stop it. I think people in those countries who really want to get around the filtering can, and our goal is to lower the bar so that people who are casually interested can get around it, and then to the point where, you know, even your mom, if she lived in Saudi Arabia, could get around the internet filtering, you know, that...
Yeah, but
that.
Wait a minute. Aren't you afraid that one of these days you're going to get this knock on... Chinese? Well, like, I didn't order Chinese, and you open the door, and then, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's some people
you
said,
up,
you know, what if they send Chinese Jack Bauer out to come and take me out, and I just, well, the thing is that, you know, I've wondered a little bit about that, but also at the same time, if something happened to me, it wouldn't really stop the software from continuing to work, and probably the result would be vastly more publicity for the software, more people using it, without any benefit to the people who came and nabbed me, because, you know, everybody would still be able to continue using it as before.
So is that your ultimate goal, then, to transcend your, you want your software to transcend your own life? Or your techniques to outlive you?
Well, it could potentially outlive me. I don't want to die right now to prove that it will outlive me, but it
could. Are you sure?
The only way to prove it would be to die.
Right.
But it's written in such a way that in theory, you can demonstrate that in theory it would outlive me, but I'm in no hurry to prove it.
Now, you say it's written in such a way. I mean, is your software open?
It's freely distributed.
Okay.
And, I mean, it wouldn't do anybody... The bottom line is that it wouldn't do anybody any good if I were kidnapped or disappeared.
So all you do is just sit around all day just looking at scans. scams and looking at ways to get around software that blocks people, or what, how do you make your living?
Well, I work for some people who pay me to look at ways to get around software that doesn't block people. I mean, just looking for security holes and things like, I've done some work for Gmail, like ways that a Gmail message sent to a Gmail account could compromise that account, or security holes and things like the Macromedia Flash Player, doing testing for them. Anonymizer, eGold, a company that's like PayPal, except you pay people in a balance that's equivalent to a certain number of precious metals. Because they're like these hardcore libertarians, and they think, you know, U.S. dollar is a symbol of the United States fascist oppressor government, and the only real money is gold, or, you know, whatever. But they have this site that was good for testing the security on it. I do a lot of that kind of thing. A lot of them are not really, like, geeky, obscure security holes. Some of them are, you know, the best ones are really straightforward to explain. Like, on Yahoo Personals, there was this thing where you can reset a Yahoo account using a zip code and a birth date. Yahoo Personals has these features where you view someone's profile, and it has a bunch of information about them, age, city, gender, and so on. You're looking at that information, think, what's on that page that could enable you to reset their password? How would you get all the necessary information from someone's Yahoo profile? What would you look at? You'd say you wanted to get their zip code, so it's got their city. So right. That's the easy one. It narrows it down by about 10 possibilities, usually. Now you want to get their birth date. What do you do? What would be a likely area where they'd overlook
age.
Something? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then what happens?
Then you're their sign.
Well, that's good. That'll narrow it down to maybe like 30 possibilities.
Right.
But if you have lots of time on your hands, the thing is you can check the page every day. When their birth date passes, Yahoo automatically changes their age that's displayed. And then you know their birth date, and then you can get into your account. I mean, the real problem is that zip code and birth date are not really very secret information anyway. You can usually get that from somebody. And that's true for a lot of places like Yahoo and Hotmail.
Just calling them up.
The reset password procedure on most of these is very weak. And the secret questions, the default is usually something like, what is your pet's name?
Right. Maiden name.
Yeah.
Right.
Or what is your pet's name is even worse. Because at least if someone asks you, what's your mother's maiden name, you'll wonder, you know, why is that guy asking that?
Right.
But I could ask a girl, oh, what's your pet's name? And, you know, their guard won't be up. Well, their guard will be up, but that's because it's me. I mean, it won't go up more than normal because I asked that.
Right. So what are you suggesting then? I mean, for people to protect themselves from a lot of these, in your opinion, just nefarious things?
Well, like security holes in software are one thing. I think it's good that companies have gotten bad publicity for not paying attention to that. So, you know, it's encouraging that a lot of companies pay more attention than you'd normally expect them to. For individual people, I think there's, you know, I hate to say it, but it's almost like common sense after a couple of months on the internet, a sampling of a couple of the emails you get and look at the scams that are out there, you sort of get a feel for what's a legitimate message from a company you've signed up for versus what is a phishing attack. I think that...
Yeah, I don't know. Ponzi gets tricked by a lot of those a lot. I mean, she'll ask me, she says, is this, you know, legit or is it not? I'm trying to teach her slowly but surely, like, no, that's not, and this is how you can tell. But sometimes she'll get it, sometimes she won't.
And what's her email address? You mean if I send her a message saying I'm from Citibank and saying that I want her account number?
She won't. No, there's no way.
No.
You could try. Actually, it'd be interesting.
Okay.
Could you do that?
To test Ponzi
to see what happens?
I'll have to have a look around the house to see, well, you know, what companies she gets her mail from and stuff like that.
I'm not going to tell anything on the radio or whatever, but do that. Just to see
okay.
if she...
But then she's going to deny it. She said he must have had a look around while he was over visiting
right.
your house.
Exactly.
And you're going to get in trouble, and you'll still be able to say, anything I did.
Right. Yeah, definitely. So what do you think about this Mark Rasinovich going after Sony for their rootkit on their CDs?
Because
I can imagine this is right. This has got to be right up your alley.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if you buy a product from a company, if it does anything surreptitious to your computer, I believe that that's a form of fraud. I mean, especially this is an extreme example where the installing the software deliberately compromises your computer so that it can be remotely attacked by apparently anyone and not just Sony. But, you know, if a software just has a bug in it that causes that to happen by accident, that's one thing. But if a company is doing it on purpose, then, yeah, I mean, I think that's a form of fraud. You could... You know, I mean, imagine a lot of these things, if you analogize it to something happening in the physical world, you could hardly believe that a company would try and get away with that. I mean, that picture you have hanging on your wall, would you be resentful to find out that the person who sold it to you had embedded a little hidden camera in it, or, you know, a device that would somehow remotely disable the locks on your home so that they could get in? I'd imagine you'd be a little pissed. But, you know, people... I think people think of it as less serious when it's done to your computer for some reason.
Well, how can they stay protected? I mean, yeah, watching the evening news is somewhat helpful, but what's a non-geek supposed to do about this stuff?
Become a geek.
Oh, that's
that's one thing.
Well, that's a big problem because I mean the learning curve for that is just tremendously steep.
I think on the one hand, because this is something I've tried to think about a lot, what would be a magic bullet that would help make things more secure for everybody? I think that in addition to companies making their software warn you about things that you're doing that are potentially dangerous, on the other hand, a big problem that I see is that some software warns you too much and too often, and that it sort of dulls people to it so that they get so many warnings that they don't realize it when they're about being warned about doing something that's truly dangerous. For example, I don't think that email programs should warn you about things like images that somebody sends you, because those are not dangerous unless your system is already insecure. And if you get lots of warnings about opening image attachments, then you're not going to pay attention when somebody sends you a virus named Perillo.exe, which is truly potentially harmful.
Oh yeah, I am a harmful virus. That's the name of my blog, actually, Perillo.exe. Well, C:/Perillo.exe.
That was for your audience. That was for the geeks.
Yes. Like they would know, right? Like anybody visits my blog on a semi-regular basis.
So, I'll link to you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. You do send out emails every once in a while with some news about something that's happening or something in your world. I mean, you've got a like an email list of sorts then.
Yeah, I've got a press list, I guess is what you're on. Then we've got a membership list. I got sort of bypassed by the whole blog revolution. I didn't know if I'd have enough to say regularly, because especially if it's just Peacefire theme stuff, it would be sort of one note, this is what this program blocks. They claim that they are an accurate piece of software and that their filter is well tested. This is what they really block. Then the next week, here's how you get around it, and then repeat, alternate back and forth between those two themes indefinitely. So, I never really thought of putting a blog together. Or, I mean, I've thought of it, but I never really felt like I had enough content to make it sort of blog-ish.
Well, yeah, newsletters are still around, certainly, but the blog has definitely overtaken it in terms of popularity and usefulness.
Mm-hmm.
Interactivity, especially. Yeah. Modularized.
I mean, I think one of the frustrating things about the blogosphere is it's not really like a meritocracy where, you can put out something really insightful and just naturally expect it to filter up to the top because of how insightful it is. I mean, in a true meritocracy, something that Glenn Reynolds posts on Instapundit and something identical that somebody else posts on a blog that nobody's ever heard of should, rise up through the blogosphere with the same speed. And I don't think that is how it currently works.
It isn't.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that one of the problems is that because a lot of people believe that is how the blogosphere works, that has removed more of the incentive for people to try and create a system that truly does work that way.
Well, how could you create a system that would work that way then?
Well, I try to think of like a simpler example would be, let's say you wanted to build a music sharing site, and you wanted to make it possible for a new artist to submit a piece of music, and it would be purely on the merits of the piece of music. It would either rise or fall, but it would happen very quickly in a real meritocratic way. Let's say you divided users up by their tastes, country, 80s, trance, whatever. You post a new trance song to this user group. Now, at first, the system selects 10 users at random from within the system and lets them sample it. If they give it an average high enough rating, then it gets sampled by another 100 randomly selected users. And if they give it a high enough rating, then it gets propagated out to everybody else.
Interesting.
In this way, and the nice thing is that...
So wait, why don't you build a blogging type of tool content-wise
sort
to do that?
Yeah, I have these lots of ideas, but they wouldn't really work until they reached critical mass with a certain number of users participating with them. See, this is the kind of thing where it won't work unless the number of users in the system is large enough that you'd have some benefit by having it randomly sampled by 10 users before pushing it out to all 100,000 or whatever. And I think that's...
What's your critical mass number?
It's hard to say. I don't know. I mean, if it's sampled by 100 users before it's pushed out to everybody else, where if your total number of users is only 200, then you haven't really saved anybody any work. The nice thing about this system is that bad songs will only waste time of, on average, 10 or 100 people, whereas good songs will be able to go out to all 100,000 people or however. So your larger number has to be much bigger than your smaller number in order for the benefits to work. And it has safeguards against people trying to scam it by, say, creating fake accounts to give high ratings to their own stuff. Because if there are, say, 100,000 users, in order for you to comprise a significant number of the 10 users that get selected at random, you have to have you have to control a significant proportion of the accounts across the entire user base, and that's really difficult.
So that's one idea you've come up with. You've come up with others, then apparently you can't move on.
Oh, about stuff that like wouldn't work unless lots of people do it all at once. Yeah, I mean, I think
or just anything. I mean, well, hell.
Take for example, if you had a system where, because this is another thing I was talking about on a mailing list recently, where if you have, let's say, if you receive a piece of spam, you enter the sending IP address, you report it to this database, and the ISP gets a complaint and says, if this IP address continues sending spam, we're going to sue you. And let's say if it was a particular address sends lots and lots of spam, lots of people report it. If the ISP does nothing, then you know future recipients of the same mail can get together and can sue that service provider. But I don't think that will work unless a high enough proportion of spam recipients are participating that a given spammer is likely to hit many of them.
Well, what about working with like something like the Spambase project or something like that?
I think there are existing systems that maybe would be able to integrate something like this. But I've always very wary of anti-spam systems that would make it possible for an anonymous attacker to cause trouble for an innocent party. Like Spambot was a trivial example. Anybody submits a report about some site for any reason, and it gets blocked.
Yeah.
What I would propose for something like the system I was talking about is if you want to report a complaint, because the people who participate in the system are participating with the idea that if somebody doesn't stop spamming them, they will eventually sue them, there's no reason that you can't participate under your real name with your real identity and have those identities verified. And that way, that will cut down on people filing phony complaints because, well, first of all, you're not going to be able to file phony complaints under 5 different identities in different states if the system verifies your identity. And that's easy to do. You just send someone a postcard with a 6-digit number and say, to complete registration, you have to at some point enter this 6-digit number so we know that's really your address.
Do you think net identity is going to hurt the internet or help it?
I'm not in favor of anything that would make most interaction on the internet identifiable. I'm just thinking this is a very specific case, which is
sure.
The exception where it could be beneficial. Because you're talking about people doing this in anticipation of suing internet service providers that fail to disconnect people on their network that are spamming.
Right, do you think Microsoft's InfoCard project is going to be good or bad?
Catch me up.
It's kind of like their digital identity. So I don't know if they're going after the passport thing again, or if it's just more like being able to have your identity, like in an InfoCard, is what they're calling it. So it's your identity.
But it,
this
I
is
mean,
your passport.
It
this
wouldn't
is
follow the, you everywhere. I mean, you'd still
well,
be able to
theory,
visit
that's
sites.
That's what they want to say it's going to do. Anything
they want
that would
to make it
like
so that
yeah.
if you visit any website that they'll automatically
be
know
an
who
InfoCard
you are.
If it, well,
have,
if it's whether they know who you are, whether it's here's all my information, here's who I am, here's how to communicate with me.
Well, I mean, I'm sure they're not advocating that any website you visit would be able to randomly just pull that from your computer just by the fact that you visit them. I mean, I'm sure they must prompt you. You know,
there's probably
prompt
some prompting with account information and whatnot.
And they probably just figure, well, it's to save time with people who go to multiple websites and do the same thing, like placing orders where you fill in your address and your number, and maybe it's a standardized way of doing it would make that sort of thing simpler.
I'm still not sure where they're heading with that. I mean, there's a lot of... And since, of course, it's Microsoft, there's a little bit of worry. I'm like, is it open? Is it closed? I mean, how is this going to work in this environment of the internet and digital exchange? I mean, mm-hmm. do we really have to be tied into Microsoft more than we already are?
And now you've got a way... If it's automated, if it can be automated so that when people fill it in on a website, it's automated, it can be automated so that when a virus infects your machine, that they can get it too. Because right now, it's the situation where if a virus infects your machine, it's not going to know where to look to get your name and your address and your phone number and stuff like that. But if that's all stored somewhere where it's pre-filled in automatically,
well, did
then...
I mean, they may be doing it the same way. In Windows Vista now, certain modules are getting loaded into different memory spaces. So, your WinSock DLL gets loaded into a separate memory space when you reboot your machine than it was before you rebooted. So that way, if a virus or some malware goes after it and says, I know to go to this memory space because this is where WinSock.dll is going to be sitting, it's not going to be sitting there every single time in Windows Vista. It's going to move around in memory space.
Well, I'm thinking more of viruses that don't dig that deep into sort of like the assembly language nature of how things are working, and they just viruses that would call basically the same function calls that legitimate programs are expected to call. Like if Internet Explorer has a function that fills in all this information on a page when you place an order, you know, the virus could somehow hook into that and run the same function.
They say that Vista is going to be more secure.
What did they say about the last couple ones?
Well, they said they were going to be more secure.
Well, I think there's something to what people say about how they just get targeted because they're the most popular.
Yeah.
And, you know, all the flame wars about, well, it never would have happened if Macintosh had 95% of the market. There's no way to know that without visiting some parallel universe where Macintosh does have 95% of the market, so it'll never be resolved.
Do you think there's a parallel universe where that's actually happened?
I wonder, it'd have to be filled with lots of sort of artsy, craftsy type, you know, home music composing people.
Yeah, talk about hell. Ugh. All right, so what operating system do you use? Are you on Windows, Linux,
I'm on Windows.
OS X?
I'm on Windows because I write the Circumventor software that people use to get around blocking software, and in order to make it usable to other people, I have to be running the same thing that everybody else is. And yes, I get mail from Macintosh people saying, when are you going to write one for us? It's like, I don't have one, so...
buy one for me. And
That's the reality of when you're getting your stuff from a one man band, because I think they're most people would not come out in favor of what I'm doing, much less do it themselves. So I have had the good
luck. What you're doing a little noble, or?
Well, I think so, but I think that most people think that until you're 18, that a lot of people believe there should be restrictions on people until they're 18 in terms of what you can look at on.
Hell, I've met 28-year-olds that need to have for that matter, I've met 48-year-olds that should have had restrictions laid against them.
But these people never seem to remember the adults that they've met for whom that is true. They only remember the teenagers, if they've met any at all, for whom that's the case. And I tell them, I want you to watch Jerry Springer, and I want you to look at those people, and I want you to tell me with a straight face that those people on that show are more deserving of all the rights and civil liberties given to our citizens than, say, the average 17-year-old.
Well, maybe what we should do is we should issue everybody, a kid, at a certain level, you get a dipshit card. And the only way to run the computer is if you have it. And then when you get it taken away, that means, you don't have to, or how could that work?
Who gets to decide if you lose the card?
Well, then you are a dipshit. And that just kind of proves the point.
Who decides to take it away?
I think it's when you do enough things that aren't really dumb, I think, is when you get it taken away. Was it just a dumb idea just to think about?
I guess if you do enough things that aren't dumb. Nobody's ever expected to rise to a level of intelligence. You just count the amount of time someone goes without doing something stupid.
Yeah.
In which case, then they... They get to keep it.
They get to keep it or take it away, however that's.
You get to keep your dipshit card if you're not a dipshit.
Okay,
that's kind of counterintuitive.
Yeah, exactly.
I've got it now.
And then so you could use it, and that's the only way to use the computers, if you have the card.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you don't. Yeah, you don't get a card until you have proven yourself not to be a dipshit.
Well, it used to be that you didn't get a computer unless you at least, worked and earned enough money to prove that you were not a dipshit and then had enough left over to spend it on a computer.
Well, now you can buy a computer for less than $100.
Yeah, but the problem is still that if you're a teenager, you're forced to work 10 hours a day for no pay anyway. And I think this is what I argue with a lot of people, that the reason teenagers are not independent is not because they're lazy or stupid. It's because they're forced to work all the time for free. And, Chris, if you had to work all the time for free, you'd probably have to move back in with your mom and dad too, right? If someone made you work all day and you didn't get paid for it. And then if you moved back in at home, if they wanted to put blocking software on your computer and they said, damn it, Chris, this is my house and you're living under my roof, so I'm going to do whatever I want on the computer while you're using it because it's my damn computer, you'd probably be a little pissed because, it is their computer, but the only reason you have to move back in is because you're forced to work all the time for nothing. And that's why you couldn't get your own computer.
A lot of people get trapped in that cycle. So you think
living with their parents?
Well, yeah. I mean, because they can't afford to, do X, Y, or Z. Do you think that's the problem then? Or is that the system's fault, really?
Once you're an adult, you're not really forced to work all the time for nothing the way that teenagers are. You are.
Well, teenagers aren't necessarily forced to do it either. I mean, they don't have. I mean, unless of course their parents make them. That's the only.
While you're in school, I think that there are not a lot of options open to people who have to put high school dropout on their resumes. You basically are working for free for most of your high school career.
But Google's kind of changed that, haven't they? Like with their AdSense program or the internet. I mean, hell, if the internet was around when I was a teenager, I would have my life would be completely different right now.
Yeah, I mean, there are some things that if you learn, or some things that you don't even have to learn any of the stuff they teach in school before you can go out and do it. And then some things that, like programming in school, that are useful. I mean, here's how I look at it. The stuff that takes up your time in school when you're a teenager can be basically divided into two categories. There's the stuff that will someday help you make money, and the stuff that won't someday help you make money, but we sort of feel that everybody should know it anyway. Now, the second category, that's easier. All the stuff that they say that people should know, like your American history. Well, we can all agree it's great if people know more American history. Question is, why is it more important for teenagers to know it than it is for adults to know it? Because for adults, we just say, oh, they should know more. But for teenagers, we actually force them to spend a certain number of hours per day working on it, which is like saying it's more important for the teenagers to know it than the adults, which doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, it's the adults making the decisions. If anything, it's more important for them to know their American history. So
Now, for me, it's more important to know where to find my American history, and Google has just kind of solved that problem for me.
You're right. Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true. A lot of stuff, it's not so much memorizing it as knowing where to find it. But there's also stuff that you just should just know. You don't want to end up the guy that Jay Leno is interviewing on the sidewalk to show on his TV show about how damn stupid everybody is. Like, oh, they don't know when the War of 1812 was fought. You don't want to be that person. You need to know some stuff.
Yeah, but there needs to be some of those people around. Otherwise, this segment's going to die.
Mm-hmm. Well, there'll always be some. Yeah. I don't think we need them to make up, say, 40 or 50% of the population.
Well, unfortunately, it's about 50% of our audience that listens to the show.
Well, now they know when the War of 1812 was fought. Because
when was it then?
Oh, we didn't actually tell them. It was 1776, everybody. Okay, they're good.
Wait a minute. So you're telling me they named a war... How...
Because in 1776, they said, this is going to lead indirectly to the War of 1812.
Huh?
I mean, to a war that is fought in 1812. Therefore, we're going to call the War of 1812.
Wait, how did they know that it was going to lead to a war in 1812? Were they, like, in some alternate universe where things were artsy? And people used Macintoshes?
They did, yes. They looked it up on Wikipedia, just like you said.
Yes,
they typed in 1776, and they thought it'll be a war in 1812. What they didn't know was that, you know, it was some anonymous FedEx worker who just logged into Wikipedia and changed that, because I thought it would be funny to stick that in there.
Yeah, but we had his IP address, so...
Yeah, they got him.
We're set.
So, my point, if I had one, although you rather successfully...
Derailed
made me
you?
Lose, it was something about... Yes, good. It was something about... Okay, so the point is that why is it more important to make teenagers learn that stuff than adults?
It's not. Fun. No, it's like a rat in a maze. It's fun. That's all.
It's fun just to keep them in there, making
this
them
is what
slogging.
I'm saying.
You know, it does actually benefit us, because the fewer teenagers are out there actually doing the work that we could be doing, competing with us, that would drive our wages down.
Yeah.
Also, it's great for technology workers. People wouldn't have to outsource stuff to India. They can outsource stuff to Indian teenagers right here in the United States, except that we've effectively removed them from the competitive field by sticking them in schools where they have to learn useless crap all day that they will forget. And we don't have to go through that process, therefore that puts us at a competitive advantage.
Bennett, you've thought about this way too much.
How much is too much? Nobody else has thought about it at all, as far as I can tell.
So you're the only person out there who's doing this kind of stuff?
I believe there are other people who make software available that can be used to get around blocking software at school. I'm the only one who has explicitly said that, yes, we support it being used for this purpose, and more generally, we support more civil liberties for teenagers across the board. I think most people just sort of put it out there, and they know that teenagers use it. They're not against it, but they don't want to, like, paint a big bullseye on their chest and go out there saying that I'm in favor of this. I mean, I'm wondering, with these recent laws about, you know, laws against using MySpace in school. I don't know if you've heard, there's a congressman proposing a law that would require all schools to block access to social networking
sites. Well, yeah, because it's addictive. You hit refresh and you could wear out your... Look at my index finger. It's a stump. That's from MySpace, because I keep hitting refresh hoping that...
No, you got to use voice dictation software to get around those.
Oh,
give your finger a rest.
Yeah.
But see,
so they're saying that they should block the social networking sites.
Right.
Because many geeks are there. They got to protect them from the geeks. Is that what's going on?
I know, because, you know, what if these parents worrying about their children might go geek?
Yeah,
you know,
and it's a...
And they're letting these geeks become teachers, you know, working in our public schools, working around our children.
It worries me. I mean, I say if that's the case, yeah, block MySpace. Mm-hmm. If it's just leading to more geekery, I mean, it's just...
But what if the senator, making a name for himself, decides to go after what we're doing? I mean, what if they decide to pass a law making it illegal to write software that enables students at school to get around blocking software.
Why haven't they?
Well, you know, I'm wondering if it's just because it hasn't occurred to them, or maybe what's
not sexy
enough.
What
they realize is that by just in the initial stages of the debate over the law would bring so much attention to sites like ours and would enable so many, many more students to get around blocking software. That's a lot of risk, all for probably no benefit, because, you know, most laws that get proposed do not get passed. Even if it got passed, it would be likely to be challenged, because the First Amendment threshold is a lot higher for regulating what some geek does on his own computer at home than it is for regulating what students get to do in school. It's easy to pass a law blocking MySpace in schools. It's very hard to get a law past the courts that blocks someone from working on their own time on anti-censorship software. And even if it got upheld, you know, I could always just give it to somebody up in Canada to run it, and they're not going to gain anything. So it may be that the congressmen who would like to do something like that have realized that it wouldn't do any good. The question is, they might do it anyway if they think it would raise their own profile. It's just a question of, they know that by doing it, they would get they would be giving a lot of free publicity to us. The question is, do they think that the voters know that they know it? Because then the voters would blame them for giving us all the free publicity. But if they can play dumb and say, well, I had to pass a law in order to do something about this, and I just didn't anticipate all the free publicity for this Bennett Hasselhoff geek or whatever, then they could get away with it.
That's your last name?
No, it's Hazelton.
Oh.
I don't expect such people to be very informed on such matters, the congressman.
Wait, your last name?
Right.
Oh, that it's not Hasselhoff.
Right.
Oh, well, then this interview's over. I thought you were like David's brother.
You thought I had some dirt to dish.
Well, I thought, you know, it'd add something to the interview. I mean, who are you?
It was a parody of the general uninformed nature of our lawmakers.
Oh, you're okay,
perhaps not as sophisticated as I anticipated.
So you're equating our lawmakers to, say, teenagers?
No, because teenagers know who I am.
I never got the answer to the question. How the hell did they know that this war was going to be in 1812?
Because they did the math.
What do you mean they did the math? I mean, what, you're telling me they had like a slide rule that went, yeah, okay, 1812.
Well, they had a calculator. What you were going to say?
No,
36 years.
No, not in 1776. They didn't have a calculator. They may have had a slide rule, a very rudimentary one, but
a calculator could refer to any physical
person.
Device.
That, no.
A calculator could refer to a person.
A calculator was, at that point, a calculator would have been a person. Up until they started producing like actual electronic calculators, HP and whatnot.
Well, technically, a calculator is something that calculates. It doesn't have to calculate correctly. So even if you just produce an oil painting that has like a big zero at the top and then a painting of a keypad, that is a device that calculates.
It's not a very accurate one, though, right? It's like, can you imagine the frame rate of that? Because it wouldn't have one, because it'd be a painting.
Mm-hmm.
So wait, how did they calculate this? You're dodging the question effectively. How did the people in 1776 know that this other war was going to happen in 1812?
I think they looked it up on Wikipedia and they got
and
the wrong information.
You ass. You are an ass.
I told you I like to mess with stuff.
So you think they hacked it somehow back then?
No, they couldn't hack it.
They couldn't?
They just couldn't hack it.
You don't think there's...
These people these days, they just couldn't hack it.
Well, okay. Now, in terms of hacking, you think hacking just came around like in the computer age, you know, futzing with stuff, or has this been around for a while?
I think the idea of messing with stuff to see what would happen goes back pretty far. I think that, you know, people like Galileo or anybody who took conventional wisdom and tested it out, like Galileo dropping his two weights from the top of the tower to see which one would hit the ground first and proving that heavier objects do not fall faster, that was a hackerish thing to do.
Hmm.
Ancient mathematicians were hackers, too.
Yeah, and a lot of them were burned for it.
I think if you did math, you could mostly stay under the radar. There were some mathematicians that were executed for. I guess they also dabbled in subversion that was too obvious.
Like,
I don't know. Some of them got into politics.
Oh, so if you prove that like 2 and 2 does not equal 4, then you're like screwed. No, hey, you're gonna die, type of thing.
I think they were just more subtle about it. The mathematicians would go 2 + 2 = 4. And by the way, by my logical computations, Mr. Emperor, you're. And then it usually was not the math that got them in trouble, but they were smart enough to realize certain things, but not enough to keep their mouth shut.
Now, with your GoDaddy.com domain registration, as a listener of The Chris Perillo Show, enter code CHRIS1 and save an additional 10% on any order. Get your piece of the internet at GoDaddy.com.